please kneel with me in opening prayer. O God, the Eternal Father, as we bend our knee before you at this time, with thanksgiving, Lord, that we can come out of the world and to bask in your presence, to be fed and strengthened. Father, I do pray for the speaker of the hour, that you'll be with Glenn to give him freedom of thought and of speech, that he'd be able to expound on that which you have given to him. Be with us that hear his words, that we may be fed. Father, I pray that you'll be with the many sick and afflicted, that you'd be with Danny in his arm, that he'd be able to sleep comfortably, that he'd be able to rest and be about his normal things as a child, to grow and to enjoy life. I pray, Lord, that you'd be with LaVita Reed and her family, that you will comfort them, strengthen them, guide and direct them in their needs. Fathers, I pray that you yet reach out and heal her of this affliction. We place her in your hands. Be with those that are loved ones that cannot be with us this day, that are ill. Comfort them and strengthen them. And may they return quickly. Father, I pray you'll be with those that are out in the missionary field. Watch over them, protect them. Guide and direct them, I pray. And this I pray humbly, Lord, in thy son's name, in Jesus Christ. Amen. We will continue this morning with 139. When you found your places, will you rise? Well, since Glenn announced the name and title of his sermon last week, I've been wondering about it. And now I see all the gizmos and the gadgets up here that he's going to use. I can't wait. So I'll give you the speaker of the hour, Brother Glenn.
thank you, Jim. Good morning to each of you. It's good to see everyone here. And as any of you who have been here in the last week know, I put the title, my sermon, in the announcements. Hopefully it maybe might pique some curiosity, but also maybe I find sometimes with curiosity, sometimes maybe it might draw our minds in a little bit more, may think about things throughout the week, wonder, and in wondering, maybe you thought of some things that I'm not going to talk about, and you've learned something from that, so that's a good thing. But the title is, The Quest for Speed, The Guns of the Gospel, and the Armor of God. And I hope by the time I'm done this morning that you'll be able to understand what I'm referring to in this title, because it does address some of the things I'm going to talk about this morning. Scripture I kind of have to start with. You don't need to turn to it, but I'm just going to take part of it. I'm not going to go in depth, but it's in Matthew, the 13th chapter, the 3rd verse, where we're talking about Christ, and it says, and he spake many things unto them in parables. Well, a parable is a fictitious situation that's given in which one can visualize himself in order to find a spiritual parallel. It'd make it a little bit easier to understand. You know, there was a ruler that this, there was a man that that. You know, in the past, there's been times where certainly I fall far short of anything that the master could put forth, but there's been times in the past where I've tried to make a parable of sort to help illustrate a picture. Well, I'm not going to do that this morning. But I am going to build off that concept. I'm going to change it a little bit. Whereas a parable is normally a fictitious situation, but something with real-world concepts that you can visualize yourself in or happening or doing or saying. Just you learn that. What I'm going to do today is I'm going to present to you a real situation, something that's really happened. Probably many of us here won't be able to actually picture ourselves in it, because it's somewhat foreign to probably what most anyone in this room has been in. But because it's something that really happened, that had real results, I think it's something that we can appreciate and understand for that. And I'm quite confident that in this story I'm going to relate to you, that there are spiritual parallels. It's going to take me a little bit. It's kind of a long story. And so I hope you'll bear with me, because I'm going to get several points out of it. It's not just to make one point. And probably very quickly, some of you will pick up on some of the things that I'm going to use and go to and wonder, well, why does he keep going on? Because as confident as I am, you're going to pick up on some of the early points. I'm every bit as much confident that you're not going to realize the last point until I get to it at the very end of the story. And so today, what I'm going to start with is a history lesson. And the date I'm going to talk about today is May 18th, 1941. Now, probably there may not be anyone here that actually recognizes that specific date, but hopefully everyone here recognizes the era. 1941, World War II. Not a good time in world history. Millions have already died. The conquest in Asia and Europe. This particular point, the United States hasn't joined in. My focus this day is on a story that happens in the European theater. Britain's in serious trouble. Britain basically is standing alone against Nazi Germany. Much of Europe's falling, and the process of falling are in retreat. Hitler, by his military experience, was a soldier. And though in his arrogance and belief in being greater than he was, he erred in many situations, fortunately for the rest of the world. But he also had some good military plans that early on allowed Germany to conquer a lot of Europe. But what he did not have was any naval knowledge whatsoever. He really had no understanding of naval strategy, how to use naval forces effectively, having no experience. And in his pride, you know, it didn't allow him to really take a whole lot of advice from the people who really didn't know. And he began his campaign much sooner than he told any of his military officials. And that hit particularly hard his Navy, because it takes a lot longer to design and build ships than it does to build guns and tanks and planes. And as a result, Germany began World War II without any aircraft carriers, which would become during World War II the new supreme weapon in naval warfare. Began World War II without any true battleships. What he counted on was the use of submarines, U-boats. Because between World War I and World War II, Germany had been, I'll back up a little bit. In World War I, Germany really excelled in beginning submarines and use in warfare, more so than other countries, and they had a lot of knowledge and expertise. And because of that, between World War I and World War II, Germany was permitted to build submarines for other countries. And in so doing, because submarines, in comparison to a lot of other ships, you know, aircraft carriers, battleships, and cruisers, which are very large, submarines are very small. And while building these submarines for other countries, they would build some for themselves. And they had, along the coast, they'd have these underground bunkers that they'd put them in to hide them. And so they're secretly building the submarine force that the world didn't know about. And so without a real surface fleet, Germany in World War II became very dependent upon the submarines, which couldn't fight, you know, a traditional naval battle or fleet against fleet. Hitler, realizing that, used them to sink convoy ships that were bringing supplies to Europe, to Britain. And they were very successful early in the war. Far more successful than probably many people realized, even in history today, just how truly close they were to totally depriving Britain of all the supplies it needed. Because they were running short early on, and much of their supplies they were getting were coming from the United States and the Lend-Lease Act and other things that we were supplying them with, military equipment, supplies, and fuel. It all had to go by ships. In fact, I tried to find a specific quote, and I couldn't find it. I heard it once, and so I'm going to paraphrase this, but leapfrogging ahead a little bit, you know, I want to talk about May 18th, 1941, but going forward to a date that probably everyone here recognizes, December 7th, 1941, when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. And Winston Churchill, saying it much more tactfully and politely than I'm just going to paraphrase, he later made a statement that although he understood how tragic it was for the United States, it was probably the greatest day in the war for Britain, because it brought the United States in. Because what a lot of people didn't realize is that the rate the ships and supplies were being sunk, that they were coming into Britain faster than they're being consumed. And on December 7, 1941, England basically had about 8 to maybe 10 weeks' supply of fuel. That's accounting for what was making it across with the submarine sinking and everything, that it wasn't coming in as fast as they were using it. They were running at a deficit. In 8 to 10 weeks, they wouldn't have fuel for their ships, for their planes, for their tanks, for their cars. But even back before December, back in May, things were not going well for Britain. And they're about to get a little bit worse. Because on May 18, 1941... Germany's first true battleship sailed for the North Atlantic, the Bismarck. When it sailed, it was at that time the world's largest, most heavily armored, and fastest battleship in the world. But mighty as she was Germany's only battleship. Certainly not able to challenge, you know, the whole British fleet. Instead, she'd be used in the same capacity as the German submarines, the U-boats, as a commerce raider. The only difference was where a submarine would come in under stealth, underwater, try to get a few torpedoes into a few ships, and then try to dive and survive the attack from the escorting ships, the destroyers that would try to depth charge it and locate it. None of those escorting ships could even phase this. The Bismarck had sailed into a convoy, sank the whole convoy, all the escorting ships, and continue on her way. Help us kind of realize probably a lot of people aren't real familiar with some of this history to kind of help you picture this. Hopefully it shows up well. We'll find out. This is a picture of the Bismarck. You can see that. This is a person standing here to kind of get a proportion of the size. There's some people here. This is probably the easiest one. This is a person actually standing here. Bismarck was 813 feet long. Her main armament was 8 15-inch guns. A 15-inch gun is just like, you know, our 38 or a 45. That's the caliber of it. Fired a shell that was 15 inches in diameter. That's the width of it. And they stood, you know, almost as tall as a man. Like almost 1,800-pound projectile. Its armor in its thickest places was over 14 inches thick. 14-inch thick steel. Additionally, the Germans, when they built it, they found a new process in the way they forged and made the steel that is actually stronger than the steel used on the British and the United States ships. The 14 inches thick steel on the Bismarck was much, much stronger than 14 inches thick on American or British ships. She weighed 52,000 tons. And on May 18, 1941, she sailed with the heavy cruiser Prince Eugen. The British surveillance and intelligence was aware of this. They'd been watching this ship, and they knew that they couldn't let this ship into the shipping lanes. The war would be over very quickly. They had to stop the Bismarck. From where she sailed, there were four possible routes that she could take to get into the North Atlantic. So Britain stationed cruisers and destroyers along the four routes. Their purpose was to watch and locate the Bismarck as it sailed. And then farther out in the ocean would be the battleships. So once the cruisers and destroyers found the ship, then they could converge onto it. And on the evening of May 23rd, 1941, the Bismarck and the Prince Eugen, as they sailed for the North Atlantic, were spotted by a British heavy cruiser, the Suffolk. And she began to follow and give the location, and soon was joined by another heavy cruiser, the Norfolk. They followed the Bismarck through the night as the closest British capital ships steamed towards them, the Hood and the Prince of Wales. And the next morning, May 24th, the British and German ships were in sight of one another. Now, the Prince of Wales was Britain's newest battleship. Just like Germany's, the Bismarck had just said, this was her first. She just sailed, just been commissioned, finished her fitting out trials. So it was with the Prince of Wales. She had just sailed. This was her first mission. In fact, she was so new, and with the threat of the Bismarck, she'd sailed with workers still on board, trying to finish some of the last-minute preparations for her. So Germany and Britain's two newest battleships were coming head-to-head. But the Prince of Wales had been built, had begun before the war. It takes a long time to build a battleship. And between World War I and World War II, with all these navies building up their things, the major powers had entered into a treaty that limited the size. And the Prince of Wales had been built to the treaty specs. And as such, she was much smaller than the Bismarck. She was slower. She carried smaller guns, a 14-inch gun. Bismarck had been built by the same time, but the Germans lied. They knew that they were going to go to war, and by the time it was completed, you know, the treaty wouldn't make any difference. So they disregarded it. Now the Hood that was with the Prince of Wales visually was the equal of Bismarck. In fact, she was 47 feet longer than the Bismarck. She also was a huge ship. Now I know, yeah, I said that, you know, the Bismarck was the largest. Says she's the largest battleship. Because the Hood wasn't a battleship, but rather a battle cruiser. But still, really, the Bismarck was larger. She was wider and heavier by almost 8,000 tons, and most of that in armor, protection. Picture of the hood. This is a person standing up here at the front. These are all people standing along the deck. They're probably getting ready to raise the flag, be my guess, with one person out there. But can I give you an idea of the size? The hood was a large ship because the hood was built at the end of World War I, before there were any treaty limitations. But the British idea of a battle cruiser, the big guns of a battleship, but light armor so that the ship would be lighter and have the speed of a cruiser. The Hood and the Bismarck both had a main armament of 8 15-inch guns mounted in 4 double turrets. But the Bismarck's 15-inch guns were more modern. They had a rapider rate of fire. They had a higher velocity. They traveled faster, which gave them a greater range. They could reload faster. Speed was about the same, but the Hood did have a slight advantage. The Hood was slightly faster. But the Bismarck was much more heavily armored. As the battle begins between them, the cruiser with the German battleship, the Prinz Eugen. Being a cruiser, its guns were smaller. They had an 8-inch gun, but they fired faster. They reloaded quicker, and it was quicker to get the range, and quickly got 2 hits on the Hood. But quickly, Bismarck had found the range of the Hood, and her fifth salvo, a 15-inch projectile weighing 1,760 pounds, easily penetrated the Hood's thin armor. Detonated in the ammunition magazine. The explosion was so devastating that it split the ship in two. It sank completely within less than 3 minutes, and with its crew of 1,419 men, only 3 survived. Now with the Hood gone, the Bismarck and Prinz Eugen both targeted the Prince of Wales. And quickly, the Bismarck scored 4 hits, the Prinz Eugen 3 hits. While the Prince of Wales managed to get 3 hits on the Bismarck that basically did no damage. There was no loss of life. A fuel tank was spilling some fuel, but she is still fully capable. The Prince of Wales now alone against 2. Some of her guns out of action decided to withdraw from the battle. And just to continue to follow. But the other 2 cruisers, while the rest of the British fleet continued to come that direction. And so the Bismarck and the Prinz Eugen continued on their journey with the British following. Bismarck had no casualties. She's fully operational. She'd lost some fuel. But it was decided that she had suffered some damage. It'd be unwise to continue her into the Atlantic, that she'd go on for repairs before she continued on her mission. And so because of that, they decided to allow the Prinz Eugen to continue into the Atlantic to do what she could do while the Bismarck went in for repairs. So the Bismarck turned back on the following ships, not really being able to expect to get any hits, but to fire on them to give a distraction so the Prinz Eugen could continue. Now to understand what happened here, the Hood, more than just sinking a ship, was the pride of the British Navy. It was the flagship of the British Navy. Between the wars, it had carried the royal family to ports of call, the admiralty, the heads of state. It was the pride of the British Navy. Not only could they not allow the Bismarck to get into the Atlantic, not only did they want to avenge the loss of a ship, but this was the pride of the British Navy, sunk in 3 minutes. So Winston Churchill gave the directive that they went out to all British ships anywhere in the area. 3 words that movies have been made of, books have been written of. 3 instructions, sink the Bismarck. Whatever it takes. Quickly, there were 2 aircraft carriers, 5 additional battleships, another battle cruiser, 5 heavy cruisers, numerous light cruisers and destroyers steaming to the area. There were some exchanges where sight was lost to the Bismarck for a while and then refound and lost again and finally relocated. The first next attack on the Bismarck was by aircraft, from aircraft carriers. Torpedo bombers hit it with several torpedoes. Didn't slow her down. But then one found her Achilles heel. While turning to avoid another torpedo, a torpedo hit her, the Bismarck, in the rudder and jammed it. No matter what they could do, they couldn't free it. So all the Bismarck could do was steam in a circle while the whole British Navy came upon her. At 8:47 on May 27, 1941, the final battle with the Bismarck began. With all these battleships, battle cruisers, and cruisers, the British fired 2,876 large caliber shells from these ships, along with numerous torpedoes from the light cruisers and the destroyers. Obviously, some missed, but a large number hit. Soon the Bismarck's guns were silenced, decks were ablaze, but it wouldn't sink. Many of the British ships had come from a long distance at full speed. They're running out of fuel and had to turn away. The air carriers had to leave. The battleships were running low on fuel. Several of the destroyers and cruisers left because they were now out of torpedoes. They had no more torpedoes to fire at her. The ships were there. As they continued to fire, the shells began to realize that they were not going to be able to sink the Bismarck with guns. So they sent the only ship left with torpedoes. They fired them at the Bismarck, and at 10:39, the Bismarck sank. Britain rejoiced. But to the German survivors, there's a little bit different twist to it. The ones that survived the sinking of the Bismarck said, you know, inside the ship, it was intact. There was no danger of it sinking. It was incapacitated as far as battle, but the internal structure was still intact. And that they scuttled it, they sank it, because they were fearful that the British ships would board, find out information, maybe even be able to salvage the ship. So they set off internal charges and they opened valves and then abandoned ship before those final torpedoes hit. So a great debate began, you know, between over the years, many of the people that lived during the time have now passed on, but a matter of pride of Navy men and their ships, you know, whether or not the Bismarck was actually sank by the British or not. Of course, the British said absolutely, and the Germans, no. Well, on June 8th, 1989, the wreck of the Bismarck was located. And soon after, they sent down an expedition with a remote submersible with cameras. They took pictures and they found, you know, all the holes along the hull where the torpedoes had hit, and decided, oh, look at this big hole, you know. Yeah, the Bismarck was sank by the torpedoes. But last year there was another expedition. This time it was a manned one, a manned submersible. And when it got down there, it had a little remote submersible with cameras that could actually go inside of these holes. And there's a reason for that, because the Germans built their ship, or at least the Bismarck, much different than the Americans and the British. Pretend this is a cross-section of the ship sitting in the water. When the threat of torpedoes came, what the Americans and British did, they put, this is going to be thick and heavy, this is the armored section of the ship. They put these, what they call torpedo blisters on it. The idea was that when the torpedo hit, it would detonate here and not actually in contact with the ship. In reality, typically, they still blew a big hole in the hull. May have minimized it because it wasn't in direct contact, but typically U.S. ships and British ships, when they got hit by torpedoes, is very unlikely that it wouldn't penetrate the armor. The Germans did something different, something that the rest of the world laughed at. They put their armor, this is the thick, if you can see, this is the thick section, this is the armor, the heavy, thick steel. And out here was lighter armor, and they put their fuel tanks there. Everyone else, that's ridiculous. It'll blow up. It'll catch on fire. Their thinking was, if it hits in here, the fuel's going to, besides this armor, the fuel is going to act. And this isn't thin gasoline. They run on oil, thick, nasty crude oil type stuff. And It would act as a cushion, absorb a lot of the energy of that blast. If it did explode, this is heavy and thick. This has already been breached by the torpedo and thin. The explosion would go out, and still it would hold. If it caught on fire, it's not going to burn through this. They're compartmentalized. It wouldn't go, I mean, it wasn't the whole length. Each compartment's along. So just the section that got hit, it burned for a while, but it's open to the sea. Water's going to be coming. After a while, it's going to be out. Well, this expedition that went down there, they went all along the hull and looked along. First off, what was amazing, out of all the hits that the Bismarck had received, you know, her superstructure here is a mess. You know, this is blown apart. The guns are hit. You know, all this stuff up here is a mess, shambles. But the hull, that thing keeps the ship afloat. They found numerous indications of hits from the shells, but they only found four that penetrated the Bismarck's armor. And they went inside all these torpedo hits that they could get to, they breached and looked around in here, and what they found in every single one of them, the interior armor was completely intact. It wasn't bent, it wasn't warped, it wasn't breached. In many cases, the protective coating was still intact. Their conclusion, there is nothing the British did there that did anything to sink the Bismarck. Her armor withstood the shells, withstood the torpedoes. The only thing that sank the Bismarck was the decision of her crew to sink her. Well, that's the story. Probably many of you can already see or think of the scripture that this applies to. Take on you the whole armor of God. It's probably not a surprise to anyone here. And probably everyone here can recognize, you know, the weakness in the design of the hood and see the strength in the design of the Bismarck. And equally, that scripture, and we'll look at it here in a little bit, in Ephesians, about the whole armor of God. I can read it to you, and everyone sitting here can see the wisdom of that, you know, the armor of God. And yet the reality is, you know, the hood wasn't unique. They built several ships similar, British had built several ships similar during World War I, and a lot of them had similar fates. Not quite as devastating because they're fighting ships of World War I technology. Smaller guns and various, but still many of them were lost very quickly in battles. But still understanding this, you know, this wasn't like one person making a mistake. Architects, designers, political minds, the military minds, you know, they look at the, oh, this is a great idea. They thought that sacrificing armor for speed was a good thing. If it were fat, big guns and speed, and you could take on the world. But even with what they learned in World War I and seen, you know, now World War II comes, and they're sending a ship of that same construction as the lead ship to engage the most powerful weapon the world knew at that time. Before I go on, you know, I want to make it clear. Probably no one's going to misunderstand this, but I, you know, other people, not here, but, you know, politicians, public figures, they've gotten problems when they talk too much about Germany and stuff. And I want you to understand, if I speak favorably of Bismarck, I'm not a fan of Hitler or fascism. I don't wish that Germany won the war. I'm strictly talking about the construction of these ships and the comparison. But the reality, though, you know, you can look at these two ships and see the difference and see the weakness and the strengths. I can read to you Ephesians, and yet the bottom line is our spiritual lives, we like to do the very same thing. We like to do the very same things. We like to sacrifice armor, the armor of God, for our spiritual guns and our spiritual speed. If you want to follow along, I'm going to read that in Ephesians. Now, that's in the sixth chapter. Ephesians, the sixth chapter, I'm going to start with the 10th verse. Words that I'm sure are new to no one here. But we're going to look at them a little bit, and we're going to compare them with this story. Real-world circumstances that I think point out a lot of the things that are contained here in this scripture. It says, "Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of His might. Put on the whole armor of God, that ye may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. Wherefore, take unto you the whole armor of God, that ye may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand. Stand therefore, having your loins girt about with truth, having on the breastplate of righteousness, and your feet shod with the preparation of the gospel of peace. Above all, taking the shield of faith, wherewith ye shall be able to quench all the fiery darts of the wicked. And take the helmet of salvation, and the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God." The words and instructions of God here in Ephesians, He's telling us to construct our spiritual lives like the Bismarck, not like the hood. The hood sacrificed armor for speed. You know, we love speed. We love to do things fast. It's our nature. You remember when it was sufficient to get your little stamp, and you remember when you had to lick them, you didn't have the self-adhesive, you always had to lick the stamp, and you put it on the envelope, you dropped it off at the post office, and it got there in a week or so, and everybody was happy. And then came the facsimile machine, and oh boy, are we moving now. And now everything's instantaneous. I can instantly see things are happening across the world. I can get information. You can send one message, hit a button, and it goes to as many people as you want to pop up on their computers instantly. You can mark yours so yours is more important than the other guy's who's sending his at the same time. You know, read mine first because mine's more important. Remember when the speed limit was 55? You know, I tried to, you know, follow that along stuff. But I was happy when it went to 65. 75 is really nice, especially those, you know, we travel, you know, go into the, you know, different reunions and things. Those, I'm sure, that go up to pace and regularly, they like it, you know. Saves off a lot of time. We're going faster. We're getting there quicker. Getting things done faster. You know, I can now obtain and process more information in a few minutes on my computer at home than it would take me days. You would have before taken me days and weeks to find and dig up in a library. And yet I sit there and get frustrated if it takes it more than 2 seconds to download what I want. You know, I expected by as I hit enter, and I look up from the enter button, it's already there, you know. We like speed. We like things to happen quick. Guns, you know. I'm talking, you know, the hunting and stuff. But just the spiritual concept, you know. Guns, like any shit, you know, we like power. We like control in our lives. We like to command authority and think we're in charge. And, you know, we're directing things. Anything that stands in our way that we can take care of. We enjoy being the one with the answer, you know. We like doing those things. And there's the armor. Eh, that's not quite as much fun. You know, armor's burdensome. It's heavy. Weighs you down, slows you down. To think about it. Analyze it. Consider things. You know? As a police officer, you know, I wear my ballistic vest because I realize the danger's up. But, you know, I don't like it. It's heavy. Cumbersome. Can't move and turn as much. The summer, it's horribly hot. I wear it at work while I have to. As soon as I come home, that thing's gone. Our spiritual lives are much like that. We like things to happen fast. We like to see things occurring. You know, we like the big guns. We like to throw those things out there. We like to see those things happening. We like to talk, you know, Jesus Christ, the Bible, the Book of Mormon. Talk about salvation, resurrection, eternal life. We like those big guns, those things we can throw out there. Command respect and authority. But the armor that's described in Ephesians, you know, that's a little bit tougher, you know. That kind of weighs heavy on you, you know. You've got to be truthful all the time. Ever struggle with being truthful all the time, you know? Being righteous all the time? Living in peace all the time? Faith? Salvation? You find times in your life where those things aren't quite, you know, that natural inclination that we have for speed and the big guns, you know, that excitement for maintaining armor all the time, that takes some dedication. It takes some effort. It's kind of restrictive on your life, isn't it? You don't have quite the speed that you'd like to have. You know, the hood was fast, had big guns that could devastate. The theory was, if you're fast, you can avoid harm. She had big guns that anything, you know, smaller than that, she could easily take care of, and anything that was more powerful, she could get away from. Didn't work quite that way. The Bismarck was being constructed. You know, the German builders and designers, they knew that they were the underdog. You know, the U.S. and British navies had long been established, and they didn't have any battleships. They knew that the Bismarck would be outnumbered. They knew that if it was used in a military function, it would receive hits, and it would have to be able to survive. Do you ever feel outnumbered? Try and take the gospel to the world. You know, God's business is a dangerous business. Every horrible, awful, perverted, disgusting, vile thing in the world, Satan is the author, the mastermind, the creator of. And God's business is to keep that in check. God's business is, despite that, to keep some place pure that the righteous followers would have a place to inherit. God's business is a dangerous business. And we're called into that dangerous business. That's why Ephesians there, if you still got it open there, the 11th and 12th verse where it's talking about, it says, put on the whole armor of God that ye may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high place. That's the purpose of God's armor, like the armor on the Bismarck, that you can withstand. You can survive. That's why God gives those instructions. That in the battle, you can withstand. You will survive. I'd like to look at some of these elements here that we find in Ephesians. First one's truth. And I'm going to spend a little more time on this than I will the others. Not that it's more important, but I'm going to put some things to kind of set our minds and draw us into this so that hopefully the others, I won't have to spend, you know, as much foundation time, if you will. We're told the part of our armor is to have truth. When you have truth, it's amazing how convicted someone can be in their beliefs. You know, without it, how devastating life can be. We hear about it many times, how many people are extorted because of a lie they said once, that something's held against them. Living in fear because they might be found out. Without truth, you're vulnerable. And frequently we'll use, you know, speed or big guns to cover that weakness. Many times, you know, you're trying to present the gospel to someone and someone asks you, you know, what denomination are you? And you're like, how many times have I tried to explain that someone can, you know, understand it? It seems so simple to me and probably everyone here, but somehow, when you try to explain it to someone in the world, it's just like, I don't know, you probably have experienced it, you know, it's just difficult. Do you confront it in truth, regardless of the outcome? Or full speed away, another direction. If you're fearful to present the gospel, maybe you're aware that your armor is weak. Maybe you feel the inclination, you know, withhold, or maybe misrepresent when you're called upon. You know, it's you that suffers. Because that's the purpose of armor, is to protect and maintain you, that you can survive. Without it, depression, guilt, fear, loss of faith. The armor of truth is to protect you, and that's what you have to remember. The armor of truth is so that you can survive, that no one can attack you on it. And understanding that, you know, this is where we get into the trouble, you know. It's okay to say, I don't know, if that's the truth. But we sometimes feel, you know, I have to have an answer or I have to somehow explain. Especially, you know, you're presenting something to the gospel and they question, you don't understand it. Well, I got to tell somebody, I don't want to lose this person. You know, I got to have something to tell. The purpose of the armor is to protect you. And if the truth is, I don't know, that armor will withhold. You can tell them, you know, I may go, let me find out, or I can ask someone if they're willing to do that. But the temptation is to shed that armor of truth for speed. Maybe speculate an answer. I think this, or I've heard kind of this. All right, you go on, but hopefully you're getting the idea that as long as there's truth, you have that armor, and nothing can it come in and take that from you. The armor of God isn't about converting someone else. It isn't about changing someone else's life. It isn't about this great, courageous warrior who can go in, you know, like we think of the armor here, like this knight going in the battle and slaying people and dead bodies. All the purpose of God's armor is one thing, and that is to protect you. It has nothing to do with what's around you. It is to protect you. And righteousness, the same thing. To be righteous is to be moral, virtuous, just. You know, the weight of this armor should be apparent. But again, it's to protect us. We have the armor of truth, and the one I talked about, we're talking about righteousness now, but if I have the armor of truth on, you know, I have to admit, you know, that sin is often fun. Sin often is appealing. Because that's the truth. But sin always has consequences. It's fun for a time. It's fun or enjoyable for a season. But there's always consequences. And when you have the armor of righteousness, it's recognizing that. That there are consequences. Things that happen because of it. Because of it, you decide to have a moral, virtuous, and a just conduct and character. Peace. Part of God's armor. You know, we're living in an increasingly violent society. I mean, I don't probably have to tell anyone here. We can easily see some of the results of this. You know, I find it interesting that in Ephesians it talks about that peace is being shot upon, it's being placed upon the feet. That with armor of peace, you can still advance in a violent environment. With the whole armor of God, you do not need to fear. You know, but how often is this portion of our armor of peace is forfeited that, you know, we can have speed either to, you know, run into a battle or to flee from it? You know, we get something, you know, I mean, it's just frustrating or upset. You know, we either want to charge in there and take care of it or we just don't want to deal with it at all. But we're commanded to have the armor of peace as part of our God's armor. Then in a violent, chaotic turmoil of life, we have peace. That we're not going to get caught up in that. We're not going to get caught in to accelerating, going quicker than we think we should into something where we shouldn't be. But at the same time, we're not going to be caught that we're going to go the other direction. We consider the fact, you know, the conditions we see around us, you know, continue to be worsening. You know, I find anymore, you know, I can't go to the store without seeing or hearing something offensive. You know, someone's saying something or they're wearing something or whatever. You know, it's becoming increasingly impossible. You know, I can't drive down the road without seeing some advertisement or a bumper sticker or something. I can't stand in my front yard. We live not too far from a high school, and when it lets out, you know, not that it happens there at times, but there's a bigger number of pedestrians going in front of my house from high school, and the language and the things that they're talking about. You know, I can't go to work. Now, my job as a police officer, you know, I expect that I go out to calls, I'm going to have to encounter all these things. But I can't walk into the precinct and sit down without hearing something offensive. Same as if you're going to school television, you know. How hard is it to find a decent show to watch? If you finally find one, you think, well, the show's okay, and then a commercial comes on, and you can't continue to watch the show because of the horrible commercial. Now, I don't know this to be fact, but I want you to consider it for a moment. Consider the possibility. If you see these things around you increasing and creeping upon you and more difficult to avoid, maybe God's giving us a message. Maybe God's telling us, if you will not engage the enemy, I will bring the battle to you. I will bring the battle to you. If you feel that the armor's thin, you better get it on, because the battle's going to be here. You know, so often, you know, we think that, like this history here with the Bismarck, the Hood, these great fleets. You know, so often, you know, we think that we're steering the ship. You know, we're selecting the speed, we're picking the targets, and we're firing the guns. But we're not. It's God's Navy. You know, He's the Admiral. He decides the battle plan. He decides the course. What He asks of you is to be ready. And to be ready that you have His armor on. I'm going to ask you, I'm going to ask something here. It's a little bit different than a lot of times we do here. And it's going to take some trust on your part, some trust of me on your part. I'm going to ask you to make a commitment, a vow, a promise, if you will. And it's going to take some trust because you don't know where I'm going with this. So you have to trust me that this is something good, something you're not going to regret after you said it. It's kind of like, you know, when they have the guy stand up here and tell him to close his eyes, fall backwards, and trust the guy behind you is going to catch you. And so I'm going to ask you to repeat something after me. I'm going to start really easy. One word. I want you to repeat this back. I. Make it now known. No, no. Before everyone here, that I now resign as ruler of the universe. Oh, can you just relax now? That burden's gone. You know what? Tomorrow morning, it is now no longer your responsibility to make sure that the sun comes up at the time it says sunrise in today's paper. Tonight, you don't have to worry that all the stars are out and where they're supposed to be. It's not your concern if it's going to rain at the end of the week or not. It's not your concern to figure out who's going to get salvation and who's not. Your concern is that you have on the armor of God that includes faith and salvation. You know, that we have that protection. You know, Ephesians 6:16 says, wherewith you will be able to quench all the fiery darts of the wicked. And how much of a beating does faith take in our lives? You know, it's probably the first thing that we discard for speed and big guns. Down on your knees from some need you're praying about, you know, faith out there, and you get up, ain't happened, I'm going to go do it myself, you know. Well, I've given God 2 weeks, ain't happened, I'm going to do it myself. I've been waiting for an answer, I got to do something, I can't wait any longer. I said yes or no, just tell me what to do, and it hasn't happened, I'm going to have to make the decision. Faith is probably the one that we're quickest. The armor of faith is probably the one that we quickest sacrifice for speed. More than any of the rest. Which one do I have up here? Bismarck. That's what I'm going to talk about next. The perfect. You know, just another picture. You know, the Bismarck was outnumbered. I mean, the one ship on the whole British Navy's coming out. Do you feel outnumbered at times? All the time? Representing the gospel and trying, you know, do you feel outnumbered? Her rudder was jammed. Ever feel like you're going in circles? Her guns were silenced. You're at a point, there's just anything left to say, you know. I mean, just there's nothing left to say here, you know. Bismarck was beat up. Airfield beat up, you know. It was wore down, broken down. If you feel like that, that's all right. If you have on the armor of God. Because if you have on the armor of God, you're like the Bismarck. Because it was the Germans' decision that that ship sink. There was nothing the British did that put that ship on the bottom of the sea. And that's the way God's armor is. God's armor will withstand everything and anything that this world has to throw at it. The only way that you can sink is if you decide to. Over the past, well, it's been a while now, but months, you know, I've done tried to do a series of articles in the Hand of Fellowship about martyrs for Christ. I think some people thought maybe it's kind of depressing and they didn't like that. But the point is exactly in this message today. As those people had on the armor of God, there was nothing in this world that could shake them. They're being burned alive and singing praises. They're being impaled, they're being drowned, hanged. And nothing fazed them. Because they knew that they could not be sunk. You know, Nephi, bound and beaten by his family, how many times was he on the receiving end of that? But he had on the armor of God. You know, Abinadi, about to be burned, still not shaken. Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, going to that fiery furnace, complete conviction. Paul. You know, I could list many, but Paul in 2 Corinthians, the 11th chapter. Familiar words. 2 Corinthians 11, starting at verse 23. Are they ministers of Christ? I speak as a fool. I am more in labors more abundant, in stripes above measure, in prisons more frequent, in deaths oft. Of the Jews, 5 times received I 40 stripes, save one. Thrice I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. Thrice I suffered shipwreck. A night and a day I have been in the deep. In journeyings often, in perils of water, in perils of robbers, in perils by mine own countrymen, in perils by the heathen, in perils in the city, in perils in the wilderness, in perils in the sea, in the perils among false brethren, in weariness and painfulness, in watching often, in hunger and thirst, in fasting often, in cold and darkness. God's business is dangerous work. But when you have on the armor of God, you can withstand and nothing can cause you to sink. All these individuals, they didn't sink, they didn't succumb, they didn't collapse with all these things because they had on the armor of God that will withstand anything and everything that the world has to throw at them. I want to consider a what if we will, for a moment. Going back in our history lesson here, you know, the Bismarck was a burning wreck. All whole upper section was a mess. Burning. Shot up. But her internal integrity was still intact. The British shells were having no additional effect on her. They're also running low on fuel. Many of them had already turned back because they're out of fuel. Very shortly, all the rest would. They just fired their last torpedoes at her. It sank because the Germans had scuttled her. But they believed that they'd sank her because they fired the torpedoes and within a few minutes she'd gone under. If the Germans hadn't scuttled her, she had still been afloat. And at some point, they ought to realize that there isn't anything they can do and they're out of fuel and they would have had to leave. They probably could have called more ships, but it would take all the close ships had already come in on it. There weren't a whole lot of British ships. They were nearby now. If that had happened and she was still afloat, if German U-boats that were en route, but submarines are slow, it takes them a long time to get anywhere. And the U-boats had arrived and set up like a perimeter around her to ward off any attack, any ships that might be coming. And they got another ship out there to tow her for repairs. And they got her into dock, repaired her, and she sailed again. You know, it'd be the greatest survival story in naval history. Well, something like that did happen. And it's Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ is the perfect example of the perfect, whole, and complete armor of God. The example that we need to look to if you want to see the complete and whole picture of the armor of God. Consider this, if you will. The mark, I'm going to go through these kind of quick, so they're just short verses, so don't spend time looking to them so I can not take too long here. Mark 14:43. It says, and immediately while he spake, talking out there, immediately while he yet spake, cometh Judas, one of the 12, and with him a great multitude with swords and staves from the chief priests and the scribes and the elders. This is when they're coming to arrest Jesus. And then Luke 23:23, it says, and they were instant with loud voices, requiring that he might be crucified. And the voices of them and of the chief priests prevailed. Was Jesus Christ outnumbered? Yes. Consider this, in the 14th chapter of Mark, starting with the 7th verse, we're talking about Peter. This is after Christ has been carried off now, and he's in his trial. And it says, and he denied it again. And a little after, they that stood by said again to Peter, "Surely thou art one of them, for thou art a Galilean, and thy speech agreeth thereto." But he began to curse and swear, saying, "I know not this man of whom ye speak." Christ, the disciples didn't follow. Peter denied. Was he alone? Yes. Consider, if you will, when he was first arrested, who came and got him? You know, the chief priests and the leaders and stuff. And where did they take him? They took him to Pilate. Pilate says, "You know, I don't want this mess." He gave him to Herod. Herod said, "Go back to Pilate." Pilate says, "Okay, I can't do anything." Give him back to the priests and stuff. Is he circling? Do you see his big circle? He ended right back where he started from. Isaiah 53:7 in prophecy of Christ says, "He was oppressed, he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He was brought as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before his shearers is dumb, so he opened not his mouth." And we find it fulfilled in Matthew 27:12, where it says, "When he was accused of the chief priests and elders, he answered nothing." Had the guns fallen silent? Yes. We can read, you know, he was beaten, he was spit upon, he was scourged, he was crucified. Was his physical body a wreck? Yes. In John 19, the 33rd verse, it says, but he's hanging on the cross to the end of the day. And it says, but when they came to Jesus and saw that he was dead already, they brake not his legs. But one of the soldiers with a spear pierced his side, and forthwith came out their blood and water. The final torpedo. But Jesus Christ had on the complete, the total, and the perfect armor of God. And when he had that, there is nothing in this world that could cause him to sink, to fail, to succumb. And because of that, we find the result in the 24th chapter of Luke, starting with the 4th verse, where they came to find his body. It says, as they went before there, it says, it came to pass as they were as much perplexed thereabout, because they can't find him, two men stood by them in shining garments. And as they were afraid and bowed down their faces to the earth, they said unto them, "Why seek ye the living among the dead? He is not here, but is risen." The armor of God in complete perfection will protect you against anything this world that Satan, or anything you come in contact with, might try to take from you. We don't need to have always the big guns. We don't need to be the fastest. We don't need to be the quickest with the answers. We don't need so many things that our natural tendency to think we need. It's God's army. It's God's navy. It's His battle plan. When He wants you to move, He'll tell you to move. Where to move, and what to speak. What he asks is that you be ready. And you be ready in such a condition that when you're called for whatever it is he asks or requires or requests, there is nothing that can penetrate that. Because when you have on the armor of God in truth, in righteousness, peace, faith and salvation. When you have that complete armor on, you can stand against anything. Against anything. There's only one thing that can cause you to sink or fall, and that's your decision. I hope that this morning I've been able to use some historical parallel, if you will. Certainly this is nothing like what we're talking about, the armor of God, but to draw that parallel, the difference between ships that chose to go without armor and what happened, and those that realize the importance of that protection. that we aren't all called to be the great spokesman for the gospel, to be the missionary, to be the person who converts everyone in. Some are going to be called to that when God chooses to do so. But we are all, every one of us, called to have on the armor of God. And it's because of God's love, because He knows if you have the armor of God, you cannot be lost. You cannot be lost. Because it's God's armor. And it cannot be penetrated by anything in the world. It's my prayer that we might always have that armor and that God might bless us, that we might always be faithful to every day make sure that we have our armor on. Thank you.